There you go. There you go.
We'll call the meeting to order. This is a State Government Finance Committee meeting for February 14th, 2012. And happy Valentine's Day to everyone. And the chair didn't let you down. I have a little treat for you as you leave. In that pink box on the end, have a little chocolate treat on me. And enjoy the day. We have before us the minutes from our last meeting of February 9th. Would someone move those minutes?
So moved.
Moved by Representative Gauthier. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Members, what we're going to do today is to hear from a number of our colleagues about specific bonding bills that they have introduced where we felt that there was something that we as a committee need to review. And we are not going to actually vote on any of these today. We've got in your packet a sheet that lists all of the bonding proposals that come under the jurisdiction of our committee. And what we're going to be asking you to do is to indicate yes or no or pass on any of those items on which you have an opinion or don't have an opinion. And we will be collecting those after we finish all of the bonding issues. We've still got some more to go after today. And so keep it in your save file folder, if you would, and don't take it with you, so you have it here next time to further add comments to it. Before we get into that and start hearing the presentations, Ms. Roberts is going to go over the memo that she's prepared. It's in your packet as well, so if you would take that out, and Ms. Roberts, would you proceed?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, the memo in your packet is a summary of the governor's bonding recommendations for this committee. Those recommendations were released in January, and I should note this memo is part of a larger summary that our department does of all of the governor's bonding recommendations. In addition, there's additional detailed information available on Minnesota Management and Budget's website, and if members would like, I could email the links to you if you want to see additional detail on these projects. So briefly, in summary, Governor Dayton has recommended 15 projects, which total $136 million, out of a total of $187.6 million that were requested by the agencies that are under the jurisdiction of this committee. You'll see a chart on the first two pages that shows both the agency request and then the governor's recommendation for each agency. And real briefly, I'll start on page 2. You can see under Department of Administration, the governor has recommended $32 million for five projects. First is $21 million for asset preservation. And this recommendation does include $13.5 million for the capital, which would be used for stone repairs on the exterior, and then $1 million for the critical HVAC and plumbing repairs. And then in addition, there's a recommendation of $7.5 million for the Centennial Office Building to replace electrical systems. In addition to the asset preservation recommendation, there's a recommendation for statewide CAPRA, that's the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account. This is a recommendation that is typically in every bonding recommendation from various governors. The recommendation is for $2.5 million. And CAPRA is actually a statewide fund. It's administered by the Department of Administration, but it's a statewide fund that's available for unanticipated and emergency requests. If agencies have known asset preservation requests, those are made in a separate request, and you'll see there was a request for the Department of Administration that I already discussed, and we also have a request from the Department of Military Affairs for asset preservation. And if you are on other finance committees, higher ed, in a similar way, will have a request for asset preservation, and I believe DNR also does. On page 3, and continuing on to page 4, there's a chart that just explains some of the sources of funding that are used for repair and maintenance for state buildings. Again, the asset preservation, which are known requests, CAPRA, which are the emergency requests, and then the facilities repair and replacement account, which is also administered by Department of Administration to repair buildings that are really in the capital area. In addition to those requests for our recommendations for admin, there's 3 other recommendations from the governor. Funding for the University Avenue Tunnel, which we've already heard in the bill from Representative Loeffler. $1 million for agency relocation. And then $900,000 for parking replacement in the capital area. This is intended to anticipate the likelihood that parking in the Sears parking lot might not be available after the construction of the light rail project. Moving on, on the bottom of page 4, you'll see the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. The governor recommended one of the agency's requested projects, that's $375,000, to replace the heating and ventilation systems at the indoor sports hall at the National Sports Center in Blaine. And if you've been up there, that's really the original building up at the National Sports Center. For the Minnesota Historical Society, the governor recommended $3.25 million in bond financing for historic sites asset preservation. The agency had requested $7.3 million for that project, and we'll be hearing more from them today about their requests, including a bill from Representative Hackbarth. Under Department of Military Affairs, the governor recommended funding for 2 bonding projects. First is for asset preservation, that's $5.5 million for deferred maintenance at the armories and training facilities. The priority projects for this funding include the facilities at Cottage Grove, Roseville, Austin, Chisholm, and Pipestone. And then in addition, there's $19.5 million recommended for the Camp Ripley Education Center. At the bottom of page 5, you'll see discussion of the bonding request for the PFA, which we heard at the last committee hearing. And then finally, on the last page, there's some discussion of the recommendations for Department of Veterans Affairs, a recommendation of $29.8 million, which includes the Minneapolis Nursing Care bed replacement, Minneapolis Building 13 Central Pharmacy, and, again, asset preservation requests. That's a brief summary. And again, if you'd like more information or access to the detail on the governor's page, I can send that out to the committee.
Any questions for Representative Kahn?
In the Mr. Chairman, Ms. Roberts, in military affairs, in the appropriation for the Camp Ripley Education Center addition, isn't there any federal funding in for the construction of that? And why not?
Ms. Roberts?
I will have to look that up for you. You're right. For most of the facilities in military affairs, is at least shared federal funding, but I'll find out the details for this particular one.
Okay. And then another question.
Representative Kahn.
No, I guess that's probably more appropriate when we get to the Mighty Ducks one. I'll leave that.
Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I have actually a question for you. And Health and Human Services, when we heard the bonding requests, Chair Abler then passed out these ranking sheets where we ranked the projects. Are we doing something like that, or how are we getting going to prioritize today? Or are we just passing them all out? Or
we do not hear.
We're doing, Representative Slavik, we're doing something similar. In your packet is a listing of all of the projects that come under the jurisdiction of this committee. And you will be asked to indicate yes or no or pass if you wish to pass on any. What we will then do is collate all of that from our committee and pass it on to the Capital Investment Committee. Capital Investment doesn't want all these individual bills going to them, but they would like our input as a committee as to whether which items we feel are priority or should be funded or not. So that, and we're asking you to save this, put this in your save file, because you'll need to look at it again next time we meet. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So when would the rankings be due? And then do you actually want a 1, 2, 3, or yes, no, maybe?
No, I think we want to just do a simple yes, yes, no, or maybe, or whatever you want to say, any comments you want to make. And and we will put that all together from the committee and send it on to Capital Investment. And Capital Investment has requested that we get them our information by the 1st of March, which is not far away.
Thank you. Sorry I was late. I if you already said that before, I appreciate
it. Well, I was going to repeat it anyway. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, we'll go down the list of projects that are before us. And first, we'll call on Dr. Elliott from the Minnesota Historical Society. Welcome. And please identify yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Yep. Good morning. I'm Stephen Elliott. I'm the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society, and I'm accompanied this morning by Bob Quist, who manages the Oliver Kelly Farm, and David Kelleher, who is our director for community relations. And we appreciate the opportunity to present to you the Minnesota Historical Society's 2012 capital budget request. I would like very briefly to describe the background of our requests, and then I know that Representative Hackbarth wished to talk to you about the Oliver Kelly Farm and Elk River. I'll conclude with our two other requests, historic sites asset preservation and the county and local historic preservation grants program. Mr. Chair, we appreciate the committee's visit to the History Center last year. We hope that this visit gave you a good insight into the work that we do. On that visit, you learned that at its heart, the Minnesota Historical Society is an educational institution. In fact, one of the oldest in the state, with our founding in 1849 by the territorial legislature. This education work is valued by millions of all ages each year, from in-person visits to historic sites and museums, and our ever-expanding work through online resources. Last year, on your visit and through the budgeting process, you had a chance to learn more about our operations. This year, we focus on the physical infrastructure needed to support this work. An important component of this educational work, and the bulk of this capital budget request, is the Historic Sites Network, which was created in 1965 by state law. Care of these important places is a state responsibility. In bringing forward this request, we have two goals. First, to preserve our state's most significant historic resources so that they'll be available for future generations, and equally important, providing high-quality service to our visitors to help them learn about the past. This is not always the case, as you'll see in a minute, with the Oliver Kelly Farm request. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we've brought forward three requests for this year's capital budget. First, historic sites asset preservation. Second, revitalization of the Oliver Kelly Farm. And third, county and local historic preservation grants. Representative Hackbarth, please. So, what is Oliver Kelly Farm and why is it important? The Kelly Farm is a part of the State Historic Sites Network. It's a National Historic Landmark, the highest designation given to historic places nationally. It's one of only 24 in Minnesota. It merits this designation because it was the home of Oliver Kelly, the founder of the Grange Movement. It's also a working farm near Elk River. Each year, thousands of school children and families learn about agriculture through their visits to the Kelly Farm. And this, members of the committee, is one of the huge opportunities for the Kelly Farm. Minnesotans and our visitors from across the country and the world learn about the importance of agriculture to Minnesota's economy.
In room 200.
We have challenges. While we've been able to keep the historic buildings in good shape, our visitor center from the 1970s needs some help. The building is an earth-sheltered structure with a leaky roof and wholly inadequate classroom and restroom facilities for today's needs. In fact, the visitor center is a bottleneck for our growing attendance. To describe some of the operational challenges at the site, I'll turn to my colleague, Bob Quist, who manages Oliver Kelly Farm.
Thank you.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Bob Quist, site manager from the Oliver Kelly Farm. The building that we have currently, the air shelter building, has struggled to function since its very beginning and in introduction in 1979. Three times the roof has come off and been repaired. It is an earth-sheltered building, concrete structure, and the roof continues to leak. Our skylight continues to leak, and now the heating and cooling system, which has kind of been a challenge over all the decades of the building. An earth-sheltered building should be easier to heat and easier to cool. The design of this building does not allow that to happen. It is a very cold building in the winter and a very warm building in the summer, contrary to what we think the design should be. And now as it's aging, things are getting worse. The mold issue is starting to grow. Skylight windows, the seals continue to fail. And then the overuse of the building as stressing our capacity considerably and literally wearing away the building. One of the huge challenges that we face, and Mr. Elliott mentioned this, is that we try to use this building year-round. We are an educational facility, and it's very hard to educate sustainable numbers of visitors in a building that was never designed for that kind of capacity. Currently, we process easily over 300 students in 15 minutes in a building that has two stalls in each restroom. Now, we see a lot of students in our educational program, and it's a very, very highly prized and well-thought-out program, but every evaluation we get back from every teacher says, more restrooms, more restrooms, more restrooms. And we're learning, we're adapting. We attempt to run the stream of visitors through as fast as we can, as many as we can, to make a safe program, and we've learned. We can no longer have two Lincoln Elementaries at the same time because students from Lincoln Elementary in St. Cloud get on the wrong bus going towards Anoka. It's a problem with second graders when you run that many through that closely. 20 years ago, classes didn't show up if the weather turned bad. And we didn't schedule groups other than May through October. But we don't do that anymore. The demand from groups is too great. And the need to run an economically sustainable program requires year-round programming. And we're doing that now. We have groups almost every month of the year. We need the space and facilities to meet the current needs, and we need space and facilities to grow the audience so we can continue to meet their needs. So revitalization will build on our strong audience and current programs. It'll give us the spaces and tools to strengthen our teachers and our programming. Half of our students right now, half of our teachers do not use the site as a social studies field trip destination. It is for science, it is for language arts, it's for math. And the revitalization will allow us to grow that space, grow that capacity, continue to work with partners. Currently we draw from 64 school districts from across the state. Teachers recognize the value of field trips. We see approximately 14,000 students in our year. We have functional space for about half of that. With the additional space, we'll be able to lengthen the length of our tour time that our visitors are there and grow that number significantly. Being close to the metro area, we've got room to also grow at 189 acres. We have the space, and we're poised to strengthen our visitors' understanding of history and agriculture. Turn it back over to you, sir. But
I see we've been joined.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kevin Heckworth, yes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Kelly Farm is located in my district. I've been working on this for a long, long time, as many of you know. I think that a number of folks have been out there on bonding tours, et cetera, and like the facility, and I think they see the changes that need to be made out there. So, as everybody knows here, sometimes things take a long time to get done, and I think this is the year for Kelly Farm. We've had in bills before, and I think we're finally at the point now where we can get something done. So thank you for hearing this legislation, and be happy to answer any questions that anybody might have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So this request will provide funding for a rehabilitated building that will incorporate a lot of the existing structure where possible and provide the facilities that are needed for our 21st century visitors. As Representative Hackbarth mentioned, the legislature has previously provided funding for schematic design, which has been completed. If this project were approved by the legislature, we would be ready to roll with construction in a number of months, and certainly by the end of the calendar year. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would leave you with this thought. In a year where you have many, many requests to fund, why fund this one? Just as the legislature will be providing funding for higher education facilities to ensure that our students receive a top-notch education, this facility will help students learn more about agriculture, one of the few thriving sectors of our state's economy. In a time when families have fewer personal connections to family farms, our agriculture sector needs smart, motivated workers who will help develop that new process or technology to make us more efficient to sell our products on the world economy. Who knows, that worker may receive his or her spark of inspiration on their visit to the Kelly Farm. The good news is that in Kelly Farm we have a tremendously important historic site that has a thriving educational program with broad appeal. But the bad news is it has inadequate facilities, has a capital project that's been punted down the road, and if punted again will now bump into other deferred maintenance capital projects. This is a project that is familiar to the legislature. You approved the design appropriation in 2008 and approved construction funding in 2010. We would appreciate your support for the completion of this project. And maybe I'll pause here to see if there are any questions on Oliver Kelly Farm before I move to the other segment.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the things I learned from former, I think when he was Finance Commissioner, Dan McElroy, is to always be really excited when a project came in with where the state funding was also going to facilitate private funding. And I think he was expressed this to me when we were at the opening of the Mill City History Museum. Has there been any attempt to get, obviously on a smaller scale than for that structure, but has there been any attempt to get any private funding for matching grants for state funding so that the state funding could help to act as a catalyst?
Dr. Elliott?
Not for the capital project there. We do seek and have partners from the private sector for programs and marketing, which is really what they want to support. Mm-hmm. But since this is a state historic site, and this is an infrastructure need that's a part of the state historic site network, we feel it's more appropriate for this work to be funded by the state so that we can concentrate on getting private support for the program and marketing, which is what they really want to support.
Mr. Chairman, how does that then differ from the Mill City Museum? Is that not a state site?
That site was put into place with some state funding, but it was a there was a lot of private money that went into creating that at the beginning.
Well, that's Mr. Chairman, that's the point I'm making. I think when you put small amount of when you put an amount of state funding in, it becomes a very attractive target for private funding. You know, this state funding will help match and help facilitate that project. I'm not just picking on you. I think I'm going to ask it for any project which you say has enormous public appeal.
Right.
I can't imagine we could quite get private matches for CAPRA funding or some of the other things, but, you know, I just wanted to know if anyone has thought of it or tried to get it for a project like this, or if we should kind of write that as a requirement into the bill or facilitate a factor into the bill.
Representative Hackbarth, did you wish to respond to that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, there's no matching money, private matching money for the facility that we're asking for here, but there is a group of people that are called the Friends of the Kelly Farm. They're very, very active at the farm. There's private funds that go towards that, and they were very instrumental in keeping the, a few years ago when they were closing down historical sites, the Friends of the Kelly Farm were there to keep the farm open and operating and functioning. And so there is private money that's going into the Friends of the Kelly Farm that are very active out at the farm, but well, not particularly for this facility.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my last question then on this is then could the Friends of the Kelly Farm be asked if they were to make some private funding that would facilitate the advancement of the state funding in the bonding bill, would they be interested in doing that?
Anyone who wishes to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. As Representative Hackbarth mentioned, the Friends of the Kelly Farm have been great supporters of the farm, but as Mr. Elliott mentioned earlier, that's largely been in the operating side. They helped support programs. While they've been extremely enthusiastic about helping, I'm not sure that there's a lot of capacity to get to a large number. I think we'll certainly ask for their help in doing what they can to support programs and parts of this, but I think that they're not going to be able to put together a huge amount of money for a capital project like this.
Mr. Chairman, last time, the question that I asked was has not yet been answered, which is have they ever been asked to do that? When you think of reading what you've said and listening to what you've said about the importance of this, and I've been there, so I certainly appreciate it, the importance of this site to agriculture. We have a whole bunch of agricultural-based companies in the state, which are probably not part of Friends of the Kelly Farm. And have they ever been asked to help do the, you know, in return for a plaque or return for anything else that they might do?
We have not asked them to support the capital and infrastructure work at the site. I guess the other point I would offer is that private support is very important to the Historical Society. Currently, we receive 55% of our operating program support from the state, which is a lot lower than it used to be, and the rest of the support for our programs and operations comes from the private sector. And if we start asking aggressively for support for capital infrastructure needs for state historic sites that's always been met by the state before, while we're meeting this other challenge, that's not going to bode well for our efforts on the operating and program side. So it's not that we're not seeking that support, but it's being provided to help keep programs and operations running.
Well, last time, Mr. Chairman, if I can just say, you have been successful in getting private support for capital expenses. Everyone understands that budgets are under tight constraints, and I'm probably willing to do a much higher bonding bill than many of the other people on this committee, probably including Representative Hackbarth. So, and what I'm just saying is that people understand that we have to look for more innovative ways to do things, and every experience that I've had in fundraising and that kind of thing has said that when there is a state contribution, it facilitates matching funds, and with maybe more, and when someone says that there's private money that will come in to match a state contribution in any proportion, it also facilitates the state one. So all I've asked really is have you tried, and I think the answer is no.
Not for this project. Yeah.
I think that Representative Kahn raises a valuable question with regard to this, and I think the question becomes even more important when you've got almost $10 million request. You know, if you're talking about a few million dollars for asset preservation or modest improvements, that's one thing, but that's a pretty big request, and I think the question is well worth consideration. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The follow-up, Representative Kahn's question, is there a foundation at the Oliver Kelly Farm?
Mr. Quist?
Mr. Chair, currently there is not endowment or foundation support for the Kelly Farm.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
My main question was of Director Quist. You said something that's, as I think about it, kind of troubles me, but I think you should have an opportunity to clarify. You said that I think the Oliver Kelly Farm was 190 acres.
Sure, yes.
And so when you were talking about metro access to metro area, that the metro area has to the Kelly Farm, you said there's room to grow. And you just have 190 acres, so what did you mean by there's room to grow?
Mr. Chair, to be clear about the room to grow, reflects that we have the physical land space to add programmatic activities without having to purchase additional land. So our any kind of revitalization and growth, and we can look at our map that's up here again, is we're not adding land to the project. It is just having the physical space to expand buildings and facilities and programming activities within our current 189 acres.
Okay. And program, Mr. Chair, Mr. Quist, will you clarify what you mean by program activities?
Mr. Quist?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. Program activities including additional cropping and gardening activities that will show over time changes in farming, making more connections to people and their food, additional livestock activities, bringing in animals to compare to our 19th century farming activities. We have right now is the current historic site is a very vibrant 1860s picture of agriculture. However, that leaves a big gap to get to where we are today and the myriad components that make up agriculture. And with both the visitor center having a classroom space where we can do classroom activities, new field space to do cropping activities, to work with our partners and tell the larger, longer, bigger story of agriculture in Minnesota, making it more relevant for people today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson and Benson, and then we need to move on, folks. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Piggybacking on Representative Kahn's question, the Friends of the Kelly Farm, who make up that group? And are there any agricultural entities that make up the Friends of the Kelly Farm that...
Mr. Quist?
Chairman, Representative Anderson. Currently, the Friends of the Kelly Farm are about 100 members. They're scattered across the country. Of about over a little over half of them live in Minnesota. Many of them are close to the farm. There are no current agricultural organizations that necessarily make up part of that. However, there are a lot of strong Grange ties. The organization that Kelly originally founded in 1867, and which is still active around the country today. There are many Grange members from across the country that support the Friends' activities, which then support the farm. We are currently partnering outside of the Friends. The Kelly Farm is currently partnering with Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council, Minnesota Ag in the Classroom, in activities. But that right now is currently where our efforts are in our ties to some other agricultural organizations.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Quist or anybody else, are those individuals that sit or that are friends of the Kelly Farm, do they give input to you as far as what they see is needed as part of the overall programmatic or the fact of what you're asking here today as for updates in your buildings and things like that? Do they, like a board of directors, would give you some ideas or thoughts of what's going on? I mean, they're really not a board of directors, but I mean, it would be input that would come from these people to say, you need to do this, need to do that, and would you be interested in doing something like that? I don't know.
Mr. Quist?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. Currently, the Friends of the Kelly Farm, they exist to help support our activities, and they really don't play a role of coming to the Kelly Farm or the Historical Society and say, you should do this or you should do that. And they were founded with a specific goal of keeping the farm open. But now they work more in support area. They fund scholarships for classes to visit the farm. They help fund some marketing efforts. They help do publicity, and they provide a volunteer corps for activities. So they really, their role hasn't been so much to tell us what to do or to make suggestions. However, as part of the over 6-year process to get to where we are right today with this plan, the Minnesota Historical Society undertook a very extensive, comprehensive interpretive planning process. We brought in stakeholders from across the state, educators, agricultural people. The former Commissioner of Agriculture helped hold one of our meetings. So we received a lot of input from audience members that are currently using the farm, people who have a stake in agriculture and history, to determine what kind of project we should have going forward. So there's been a lot of input to get to the requests that we have, and it's basically been based on audience needs, audience requests.
Thank Any you. Final comments? We need to move on, and I understand you also have a 9 o'clock commitment, too. So,
well, I would just like next briefly to describe our request for historic sites asset preservation. Our overarching goal is to preserve Minnesota's most significant historic structures for the educational benefits of future generations. We're responsible for over 130 structures, many of which are over 100 years old. On this slide and in your folders are a list of the specific elements of our asset preservation request. We have two statewide projects in which we will work on HVAC, or heating and cooling and energy efficiency projects, and a project to take care of masonry at various historic structures around the state. In the printout of the presentation, you can see the remaining specific projects and our asset preservation request. Each of these projects involve preservation of important historic structures, which requires specialized architectural expertise. We'd be happy to discuss any of the individual projects in this request here or to respond to your questions afterwards. Mr. Chair, the county and local historic preservation grants request is a program that has been in virtually every capital budget bill since 1994. The program provides funding to cities and counties to preserve their most significant historic properties. It's a competitive grant program that's helped communities across the state, and it requires a match. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we thank you for your time this morning. We would appreciate your support for funding these important historic projects, which will help to educate our citizens and rebuild our economy. And we'd be happy to try to respond to any further questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, and appreciate your being here and giving us a thorough presentation on your request.
Thank you, sir.
We will now move to Representative Davids, Chair Davids.
Right, exactly. Very cold and very
Welcome, Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. First of all, I had two bills up today. One we're passing on, and just a little update on it, that's the Preston Historic Grain Elevator site. That one is in the funding cycle and has been receiving funding as they move forward. And I'd like to thank former Chair Murphy of the Legacy Committee for that funding. And so that one is taken off the agenda for today. Members, House File 1763 is a bill for capital improvements. It's for a new building for Minnesota Veterans and Emergency Services Museum in Rochester, Minnesota. We have two gentlemen here who would like to say a few words. Arlen is handing out a couple items there for your review. One is a brief document front and back describing the project. And then the Minnesota Veterans and Emergency Services Museum board is up and running, and they have another little handout that they will, that Arlen will be handing to you. I have with me today Joe Adamson from Rochester and David Peterson from Rochester to go over some of the aspects of the Minnesota Veterans and Emergency Services Museum. And members, this is a statewide project, and it's to honor our veterans, and they have quite a collection already, and now we need a place to display this so we can share it with the world. It's in, would be located in Rochester, Minnesota, home of the world-famous Mayo Clinic that has tens of thousands of visitors every year. They have a tremendous amount of people coming through that would be able to take advantage of such a museum in Rochester. So at this time, I will turn it over to Mr. Peterson and Mr. Adamson for a brief presentation, and we'll stand for question, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Representative Davis.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Joe Adamson. Thank you. My name is Joe Adamson. I am the treasurer for the Minnesota Veterans and Emergency Services Museum in Rochester, Minnesota. This is one of my board members, Dave Peterson, to my right. The Minnesota Veterans and Emergency Services Museum was initially started back in 2008 with a group that was working with the World War II Roundtable. Back then, there was roughly a group of citizens that got together and said, hey, we need to find some way to start preserving the stories and traditions and legacies of our military as well as our emergency services. Currently, there's almost 400,000 living veterans in the state of Minnesota, 20,000 police, and 11,000 firefighters. This museum would be dedicated in the mission statement of to support their legacy and help interpret their way of lives for all of the state of Minnesota. Like Representative Davis said, this is going to be a regional museum for the state, so it'd be for all our police, fire, and veterans. The reason why we had started this museum, like I talked about before, was that there's no one place here in the state of Minnesota that houses our histories for our veterans, police, fire, and EMS. The county museums, the state historical society, they concentrate on other portions of our history. This museum would be dedicated just for that one state. We have many veterans that have passed on from World War II. They're dying every day, our Vietnam vets, Korean vets. And a lot of people ask, why are their stories important? These people have helped preserve our way of life. Today I was talking to a fellow veteran who's in the crowd, Mr. Rasmussen up there, and I asked him, what's your story? What did you do while you were in the service? And he said he was stationed in Germany. And a lot of people think, okay, that's interesting. But then you find out that his division, there's one division against how many divisions up there, Bill?
200
divisions. So here's a veteran that is on the front line who has a story about how he's willing to give his life for our country, realizing he's facing impossible odds. It's something that our youth today don't realize. We're losing a lot of these veteran stories. We're losing a lot of our history because we have no central clearinghouse for them, as well as the artifacts. This also goes for our police, fire, and EMS, as well as our stories about how the state of Minnesota preserved our way of life in both the war and in peace. A lot of you all know that our Northern Iron Range during World War II was pretty much the forge that provided two-thirds of the iron for all Allied forces during World War II. A little known fact, I don't even think it's taught in school these days. When you ask kids about our history, where do they learn it? They learn it from books. We found out more that kids want to hear their personal stories, how they're interpreted. So this brought us to the reason why we wanted to found this museum. Currently, we're asking for $15 million in this bonding bill for the bricks and border. This is going to be this museum is going to be in Rochester, Minnesota. Currently, we have over 2.75 million annual visitors to the city of Rochester. A comparable museum that's a state museum for other veterans would be in Iowa. I don't know if anybody's ever been to the Sullivan Museum down in Waterloo. But that's a designated museum just for veterans there. And Waterloo, Iowa has no other attractions, nothing else going on. But on average, their Veterans Museum sees over 70,000 visitors every year. The city of Rochester is quite well suited for a veterans museum for the state of Minnesota because of our infrastructure, airports, access to the interstate, as well as some other amenities. Whereas we feel that that would be more amicable than any other current location. Mr. Peterson here has got some architectural information on why we need the $15 million, talking about the infrastructure, and then I'll close with some closing remarks.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is David Peterson. I'm a local architect that's serving on the board. I've been involved with this group for about 2 years now. I got involved in looking at some early sites, and then have started looking at preliminary programming and concept design for the museum, and so that's what I'm going to essentially speak to is what came out of those initial at this point very conceptual ideas for the museum. And that is that we think in order to house the exhibits that we anticipate, we would be looking at a facility of about 60,000 square feet on two or more floors. As it was originally conceived, it was on three floors at 20,000 square feet of floor. We think that we're going to need approximately 2 to 2.5 acres of site. And would probably be looking at about 80 parking spaces that would have at least eight handicap areas. The building itself would house a number of functions, including exhibit space, which would be approximately half of that 60,000 square feet. And then we've got on top of that library and archive spaces, classroom spaces, so that would address the educational aspect. We've been talking to the University of Minnesota and think that they may be a partner with us and may end up sharing some classroom space. We have conservation areas planned. Event spaces, as well as a restaurant, or what could serve as a restaurant, and we feel this is really important because it would help sustain the ongoing operating costs for this type of facility. And then we have a about 2,000 square foot auditorium that could double as additional exhibit space that would hold approximately 150 seats. A small coffee shop, as it's conceived now, we would really like to see a place for the veterans to come and just come and have coffee. We've noticed that in Rochester, there's a number of places where these veterans group go to sit, and they spend a good portion of their mornings just telling their stories to each other, and this would be a great place for them as well as the visitors. And then a gift shop, and the other thing is an indoor memorial space of about 1,000 square feet. We're hoping to get this located as close to the current memorial that's in Rochester at Soldiers Field area as we can, so that we'll complement that facility. But at that memorial, it's all an outdoor thing. So when people come to that in bad weather, if the museum was located in close proximity, they could still have a place where they could come in and have quite a reflection on the memorial. As Joe said, we're planning about $15 million as the bricks and mortars, the construction budget. We've kind of laid out, and I think it's in front of you in the initial planning for the financial planning, about $60,000, and master planning about $300,000. exhibit planning, another $550,000. And so our total budget exceeds what we're asking for. We're thinking that we're probably closer to $20 million. Excuse me.
It isn't an addition on your house.
No, $20 million. Excuse me. So that's kind of the quick overview. As far as the site we have, there's a the city of Rochester has commissioned a committee that's currently looking for an appropriate site for us, and we're waiting to hear their the results of that, so that we can take the next step in the planning phase and have a building that responds to a particular site.
Mr. Adams,
thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Adamson. What is the estimated annual operational cost on this facility if it were built?
That depends on a couple of factors. Our initial estimations are anywhere from $750,000 a year on up. Some of the things that we've looked at already to fund that, and some of the questions I know are going to be coming up that I'm trying to answer before they're asked, is that we're looking at an endowment fund to be raised through private sources. We've already started working on our 501c3, and I've got that through up to the IRS. We should be getting a response back soon. Like Mr. Peterson mentioned, we've got classroom spaces, event spaces, and other areas that are going to be open to the public that we're also going to rent out and also lease out. For example, the restaurant area, we would consider that being owned or operated by an outside source, and using some of that revenue generated to help run the museum, as well as charging an admission fee, as it may be, maybe nothing for our veterans. So we're actually considering having an endowment fund off the bat, right off the top, to at least $5 million to help defray operating costs so that we don't have a negative gain any one year. Good example is Sullivan Museum, like I said, Veterans Museum down in Iowa. They've been in black pretty much continuously since they've been in operation because of donations from outside sources. A good point is that their initial bricks and mortar was a bonding bill through the state. Then after that, local businesses, i.e. John Deere, said, we will start giving you money to help fund the museum afterwards because you went that route.
Well, I think it's very important that you have a good plan on how you're going to be able to operate it. I mean, we would not be doing anyone a favor by funding the facility only to have inadequate support to continue the operation of it. And
exactly.
Obviously, capital investment dollars are not going to be available for operations.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't underscore enough the importance of that aspect of this plan. Mm-hmm. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, could you please tell me who the partners are in this?
Currently, for business partners, i.e. friends and stuff like that, we are, since we're in our mode of getting our 501c3, we're also looking for fellow partners in that. I've got a packet here of letters of support that Representative Davis will be have available to him to hand out to you in regards, but once we get to the portion of finding other partners, for example, we've got the Scott Hoser World War II Roundtable, which back in 2008 or 2004 had 40 people coming to it. Now, with every Monday night, almost once a month, they have over 400. We've talked to local veterans groups, American Legion, VFW, Daughters of American Revolution, Disabled American Vets, and local businesses about being supporters of the museum. Have we talked to them yet about the funding portion? No, we haven't, since we're not on a 501c3. As you know, businesses would like to donate to 501c3s for the tax benefits as well as other legal reasons.
Mr. Chair, sir,
do you
have Olmsted County Historical Society?
Yes, we do.
Mr. Adams.
And are they partners?
They are one of our working partners as in help. We had their past curator Tom Garcia was part of it. But like One thing that we have to realize, too, is that because county historical societies, the reason why they're there, and according to our charter, is that they are the housers of the county records and of local county history. There's no one organization in the state of Minnesota that is devoted to the preservation of our veterans, police, fire, or EMS. So your county historical society, mm-hmm. their initial mission is just to preserve the records of that county.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Sir, are you saying then that you, this Rochester, Minnesota Veterans Service Museum Board is going to be the state of Minnesota?
Yes, exactly. We
host
are,
of all that stuff?
Yes, correct. Because we want it to be for the entire state of Minnesota. We want it to be so that the grandson of a firefighter that's up in Ely, Minnesota can come down to Rochester, hey, I want to see my grandfather's fire blouse. Or if someone wants to research the Hinckley fire, they can come to Rochester. Or if a medical student wants to find out about the first defibrillators that were used by the police and fire and ambulance services, they can go to our collection that was donated by Mr. Perkins and see one of the first AEDs. We want to have one place where it's a central repository. Along with this, too, would be UMR being so close to us, as well as eight other colleges and universities. Their students can come in and use our area as one clearinghouse for that information, for reviewing artifacts, talking veteran stories, listening to what our police firemen have gone through.
If I might add...
Mr. Chair...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Murphy.
Just one last question, then. You don't have a site-specific, or you've got this group that's identifying suitable sites, but then do you have to purchase the site?
Well, we are looking at... Thank you, Chairman. Where we're looking at right now is we've identified roughly down to 12 sites. Some of it is on park land. Some of it is around local areas around the park area. So once that final determination comes down, we may have to purchase land. Or we may actually use some of the land inside Soldiers Field or alongside Soldiers Field. That's up to the site steering committee, which I'm not a member of.
Members, we need to finish this up in just a few minutes. Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a brief question. I sit on a museum board, the Scouting Museum, and I used to be on the Children's Museum Board, so know a little bit about museums. Mm-hmm. For the Scouting Museum, they took an existing facility, so a library mm-hmm. that they had upgraded, and they bought it for a dollar from the county. I mean, are you looking at any existing facilities, or are you... You know, there's schools now that are mm-hmm. sitting there. There's all kinds of facilities out there.
The initial,
Mr. Adamson.
Thank you.
Please come through the chair.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that we have looked at initially was the old county highway building and some other structures in the city of Rochester. The problem is when you have a museum that's going to be certified to where if this we want an artifact from the Smithsonian, it has to meet all these standards. So renovating an old building into a building that could be used for the museum that meets current museum standards is sometimes more cost prohibitive than taking that same structure, removing it, and putting up a new structure. So having it in an old schoolhouse or something like that, just for it to meet the environmental standards for preserving the artifacts, makes it sometimes cost prohibitive.
Mr. Chair, briefly, I know that's true. We got a grant from Representative Erdahl's committee just for the lighting in this museum because, right, it's not the same quality. So, good point.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, sorry. Sir, it says here you formed your board of directors in 2011. I don't know if it was the beginning of 2011 or the end of 2011, but I was just wondering, who are the members of the groups that are on your board, and are they private groups, or are they groups that can help fund, bring forth some funds for you, or are they just individuals?
Our groups,
Mr. Adamson.
Chair. Our groups are composed of citizens, some businessmen, a lot of people that have been involved in other historic preservation. One of them, I'd like to mention, is John Creasel, who helped preserve the Chateau Theater and for a long time was a member of the Homestead County Historical Society Board. So we're sharing those contacts, those people. For example, one of the groups that I belong to is the Submarine Veterans of America, SubVets. And So our connection's there. We have other groups that we belong to that we can generate. Tom Hosier's roundtable. We can start generating some of that additional funding through those organizations.
Thank you.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, is this money being funneled through any public entity or governmental body, or is this going to be a private nonprofit?
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gauthier, it would be, they're looking for a fiscal agent right now. It could possibly be the city, the county.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Gauthier, there's no firm commitment on that yet, but that's a work in progress.
Thank you.
Obviously, that would need to be a requirement, too, in order to get state funding on this. Chair Davids, any further comment?
Well, I'd like to thank the committee and you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill. On the form that you, or the sheet that you have there, it says House File 1762. I believe that's the bill that is sitting in the Legacy Committee. 1763 is the bill that we're looking at for the Bonding Committee. So I thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Slawick. Welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill. I think it's a very important project for the Oakdale Veterans Memorial. This is a project we've been working on for several years in Oakdale, and I want to thank Representative Lilly, who has also been involved, and Senator Wieger. And I have a couple of folks here that are going to tell you why it's important for our community. You know, in our last presentation was also about veterans. I think in this committee, we have really recognized why veterans are so important to our communities and to our state. And when we think of projects like this and does it have statewide significance, they do accept vets from anywhere in the mm-hmm. state. They have a paver project. I myself have purchased a paver in here for my father, who is was not a resident of Minnesota, but served in World War II and was in the Air Force. So it is open to all those in Minnesota. So with that, I have Mr. Dodas and Mr. Rasmussen. Thank you both for coming down.
Thank you, Representative.
Please identify yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Sure. Kent Dodas, member of the Oakdale City Council and a member of the Oakdale Veterans Memorial Committee. Thank you, Representative Slawick, for supporting us so strongly on this. A couple of comments to start with is, first of all, the request here is only for $30,000. I believe the requester said $50,000. We're only seeking $30,000. We have already raised, the committee's been together for 2 years. We have already privately raised about $18,000. We have a commitment for the additional $12,000, which would get us to $30,000. What we're looking for is a matching bonding contribution there to get us to a total dollar of $60,000, which is the cost of the project. We're able to keep the project costs down significantly because all of the work that's been done to date, design work, et cetera, has all been done at no cost and as volunteer work by different people involved in our committee. We also are getting a significant reduction on the cost of the materials due to, again, companies wanting to support this. As Representative Slawick had said, we have over 110 pavers that people throughout our community and surrounding community have already contributed in to the program. So that is kind of some of the highlights. It's a group we've been working for 2 years. We've been working very proactively to raise dollars. This would be an amount that would allow us to begin construction and completion of the Veterans Memorial in front of Oakdale City Hall.
Bill, did you want to say? Mr. Rasmussen, we're not going to proceed.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
My name is Bill Rasmussen. I am president of the Veterans Memorial. I thank the committee for seeing us today. We are looking for the $30,000 so we can do our project. We have, like Representative Slavik says, we had sold 110 paver blocks. We only asked $75 for them. to make them affordable to the citizens. Some of the area, the closest area to is Woodbury, and theirs are around $300. So there's a lot of people still waiting to buy pavers, and that's our continuous funding after we get built, is the paver blocks. They could, yeah. The ones that we put in can be removed, and a one that's already scrolled can be put back in. We have room for 500 paver blocks in there. It is a small area next to the city hall. It's going to be full of flowers. There's three monuments. There are now six divisions of these armed forces. They had added the Merchant Marines a couple of years ago, I believe. And so we'll have a monument for three on one side and three on the other side. As you can see in our handout, I think they're showing. And then there's going to be a verse, which we haven't really completed yet, in the middle with an eagle on it, commemorating people from the city of Oakdale and the area, all those who have served and are now serving in the armed forces. So it's going to be a very beautiful thing, and that's what we're working for, to complete it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slavik, worthy project. I'm wondering, your bill calls for $50,000, if you're going to be amending that, or...
Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, yes, since the funding scheme has changed, Mr. Chair, do you want an official amendment, or how would you like to handle that?
Well, since we're not actually going to act on the bill itself, but rather pass on our recommendations, I think the place where it would need to be amended would be in capital investment.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, if the members can note on their ranking sheets, it's less. Yeah. I mean, sometimes we have most of our projects, you know, members for bonding are really big, mm-hmm. and, you know, this one's really small. But this, the state money would put this over the top.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Slavik and testifiers. Thank you for bringing this forward. I just wrote a check here, so I don't know if Nora's written hers yet. She better.
Oh, I've got my paper.
Okay, you better. She's already in, so.
Is that a check for $30,000?
Yeah. Well, I was hoping you would come through for that. Yeah. But it's a nice project, and thank you for bringing it forward. And I love the matching component of it. I think that's, you know, I think that we all value that. And, you know, with so many veterans in the area and then so many returning, I think it's a nice tribute to their, and a thanks for their efforts. So, thank you. Good job.
Yes, Chair, can I make one other comment? Even though this Veterans Memorial will be located in the city of Oakdale, it's very inclusive of other areas. We have contributors and people buying pavers from Stillwater, Woodbury, other cities, so the location will be in Oakdale, but really it's open and available to any of the neighboring cities that want to recognize the military service that any of their family members have put forth.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Slavik, is there room to expand? I don't know how big of an area you have here, but is there room to expand for future projects?
Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Councilmember Kent Dodas to respond to that.
Councilmember Dodas?
Yeah, so what this is, it's going to be a plaza right in front of the entrance of Oakdale City Hall. It's a very modest proposal. There is an opportunity to expand that if necessary. Right now, we don't see the need for that, but we wanted to make sure as we were developing this that there was an opportunity to expand if necessary in the future.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming before us today, and I commend you for the work you've already done in raising money.
Thank you very much.
Representative Howes. Welcome, Chair Howes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We brought handouts, if the page could grab those. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for co-authoring this fine piece of legislation. And I brought Representative Purcell to show that this is bipartisan in nature. And once the pages have that, Mr. Sanford will explain the project to you.
Excuse me. Could we have the pages pass that out, please?
You ready?
I am. Can I get the laptop?
All right.
One moment, Mr. Chair, while we plug everything in.
Okay.
Well, sometimes you're just too loud to go back.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Bill Sanford, and I'm the general manager of Lakeland Public Television. And first, I'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity to present today and talk about our project. I think one of the things that everybody sitting around these tables needs to think about is why should we make these investments? And I'm here to talk a little bit about why the project that we're looking at is a great investment for the state. The main reason is the public. The public says yes. They like public television. We raise a lot of money in a very small community. The biggest community that we serve is a population of about 15,000. We serve a very large region. Lakeland Public Television serves from Little Falls all the way north to the Canadian border. So we cover a really large geographic area. And inside of that area, there's no other television station, commercial or non-commercial, that's providing any substantive local content. According to a recent Roper poll conducted in January of 2011, the American public rated public television as an excellent use of tax dollars for the seventh consecutive year, second only to military defense spending.
I know I'm going to vote for it.
Public television is ranked as the most trusted and unbiased source for news ahead of all the networks. Public television is ranked on top in public trust among every age group, race, income, and education level. And public television is ranked as the most widely used and accepted media brand for children. They consider it a safe haven. Lakeland Public Television is a public asset owned and governed by the citizens that we serve for a nonprofit 501c3. We have a local board made up of citizens from throughout the region that we serve. And we also have separate community advisory council that advises us on the programming that we do and helps us stay in touch with the communities and making sure that we're meeting the needs of the region. And the other thing I think that public television does is that, you know, there's been a lot of debate nationally and whatnot about the what is public television relevant right now. And, it really is, because we do things that the commercial market just won't do. We provide, Lakeland Public Television provides a 24/7 educational safe haven for children. I'd like to point out, too, that Lakeland is the only public television station in the state that continues to provide a 24/7 kids channel. It's not an area that makes money. We do a lot of things that don't make money because it's providing a service that's important to the region. We have the region's only nightly local television news, and we're kind of unique in the country. There's just a handful of public television news, and we're kind of unique in the country. There's just a handful of public television stations that actually provide news. The reason we do that is nobody else provides news throughout our entire region. The only time we see news reporters from the Twin Cities is if there's something really bad that happens throughout our region. Other than that, the good stories don't get told. We provide gavel-to-gavel state legislative coverage with our partnership with Senate Media and House Media Services. And we do primetime legislative race debates, and we do it a little different than a lot of the other public TV stations. We block out big chunks during prime time, 7 o'clock on a Monday, Tuesday night, and we'll do hour-long debates. And this fall, we're probably going to do 12 or 13 different debates with seats of the Senate and House that are open throughout our region. And we also provide local arts and culture and documentaries. We did a neat doc about Bemidji Between the Wars, and we're working on some docs right now. One is about birch bark canoes and the history of that production, and lots of different things in the works. We also provide early childhood parenting education through a lot of the programming that we provide. And we serve a large geographic region. As you can see on the map here, the two circles basically go up and touch into the Canadian border and down south of Little Falls, as I said. Then the green area, we're also covered or carried by Dish Network and DirecTV. So people down in the cities can even watch Lakeland Public Television. I hear comments from some of our legislators that maybe sit in a hotel and watch Lakeland News in the evening. So it's great that we're serving that large of an area. What we're looking for at bonding is for a building for Lakeland Public Television. And I'd like to talk about the need for that. We've been on the same area in the BSU campus for over 31 years. And during that time, we've grown a lot. We've increased our local programming. We've added local news, local public affairs, local arts and culture. The legislative coverage that we do, campaign coverage, debates. So we've really grown our services. We've grown from one channel of programming that was programmed 16 hours a day when we went on the air in 1980. Now we're doing five channels at 24/7. To support all of the local programming and channels that we're doing, we've basically doubled our staff in that amount of time. And increased our technical infrastructure to support all the additional channels and local production. And we're doing it in the same space that we have, that we started with in 1980. We've not only outgrown the physical space, but the HVAC and AC power, et cetera, we're just kind of busting at the seams, and we've got issues with the space we're in. We've had conversations with Bemidji State for actually over 5 years, and there's just no reasonable space for us that will accommodate us on the campus. And I got a little tour here that I'd like to show you. I'm going to probably have to back this up.
This is Jeff Hanks, our program manager. Hey, Jeff.
Greetings.
Right across the hall from us, there's a drum room. And when they get going on the drums in there, you can imagine what it's like trying to carry on a conversation. Now we're gonna walk over to where our technical area is, and that is in a whole different building. So come on, we're going to do this quick. And you can see in here, this is our production control room. We've got like edit bays in here in our production control room. And this is our master control room. This is Amber. She's one of our master control operators. You can see all the equipment's packed in here. We've got some racks over here with equipment for satellite receivers and whatnot. Got technical folks back here. Here's Tim. Tim does a lot of our equipment maintenance and repair and computer work and whatnot. Hey, Tim. And Jess Gall is back here. He's our operations traffic guy. We're kind of all crammed in here. Not a lot of space. Again, they're working next to equipment racks and fans and stuff. And we've got an office back here for Tom, one of our engineers, and he's kind of crammed back in the corner here as well. This is the newsroom. There's no windows. There's only one exit. It's got really low ceilings. The ventilation isn't great up here. This is where our news crews work, and I work so hard every night to put together late news at 10. Hey, well, this is the last stop of our tour. We're going to take a look at our studio. Come on, let's go this way. And this is where we do Lakeland News, we do pledge drives, we do cooking show. You know, you see all this stuff up close and personal. It looks like it's this big kitchen and whatnot. All we've done is carved out a little corner here and put our kitchen in for our Lakeland Cooks studio. Over here, you can see a pledge drive. We do pledge in this corner. Lakeland News is off in this corner. And we really have no storage in here. We kind of hide things as best we can behind curtains and behind the news set and whatnot. You can see in the corner over here, we've got news cameras and different things. So we're kind of packed in here really tight, too. And again, just no room to grow. We're really tight right now. So thank you so much for following us around and getting a tour of Lakeland Public TV. what you see in our current facility, and right now I'm standing in what will be the future of Lakeland Public Television, and we are all so excited about it. We've already started working on building plans and whatnot, and we've got this beautiful corner lot here right next to the Bemidji Event Center. It's about 2 acres, so we've got plenty of room for the building and parking and whatnot, and we're looking at 2 to 3 years to get the building going, and between now and then we've got some fundraising to do, and we certainly hope that you'll consider participating.
All right. Thank you for bearing with me during that tour. That was done a couple years ago, so we are well on our way. And talk a little bit about the proposed project just briefly here. We want to construct a 23,000 square foot public media center to serve all of northern and central Minnesota. The lot has been chosen and purchased. Pre-design and construction estimates are completed. Capital campaign is underway for local funding, and we've got over half of our local match committed, and we should have the remaining funds committed by the summer. It's a shovel-ready project with construction beginning as early as summer of 2012 if we get some funding in this bonding session. And here's a picture of the building. We're really excited about it. And here's the budget. Basically, we're looking at a $4 million construction of the building. We're looking at $3 million in state bonding with $1 million local matching funds. And one of the grants that we've already received, $400,000 from a local foundation in Bemidji, a small foundation. It's a big grant for that size of foundation. I think it shows the commitment of the region to this facility. But that's contingent upon receiving bonding funding this session. So Representative Murphy was asking about if there's local money in this. There definitely is local money in this, and we're excited about that. But again, a lot of these funds are contingent upon bonding funding. So, and then last, I just want to talk a little bit. We do an annual preference poll that we send out to our members, and a lot of people will just unsolicitedly write some comments on these preference polls. And these are things that have come in about in the last month and a half. Your stuff is life-changing for us and highly valued. Keep up the good work. This is a local television station. I love that local news is covered. Public television is great. When I need good, factual information, this is the place to be. When we have time to watch, we almost always turn to public television. We appreciate your intelligent approach to programming. And we would be lost without public television. Chairman and committee members, thank you for letting me talk a little bit about our project, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
We need to keep moving here. We have two more bills to hear, but Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question first. You guys do great work, so congratulations.
Thank you.
But my question is, is the matching contingent upon getting all of this money or some portion of it, or what is the foundation said, for example?
Well, I think the wording, Mr. Chair and committee member, I think the wording is that we need to receive the $3 million of bonding funding to get the $400,000 grant.
Representative Meline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sanford. I think that you're right on that Lakeland News really is an invaluable resource in northern Minnesota. My question for you, I'm a Bemidji State grad myself, but does the university have any opinion on the fact that you're going to be moving off of their campus?
Well, we have a great partnership, Mr. Chair, committee member. We have a great partnership with the university, and we have their full support. I have a letter of support from Dr. Hansen, the president. And we will continue to have a strong relationship with the university, continue with internships, continue with labs with the university. They're excited and, in fact, have actually grown their mass comm department and see this as an opportunity.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, I appreciate your considering this. This is in right in Bemidji, in the middle of my district here, and you know, this public TV stuff is a labor of love. Nobody's getting rich on this, and that's no more highlighted than the fact that they cover the state legislature gavel to gavel, and that, you know, that's a labor of love in itself. And some of my constituents would argue that that's torture, but it's really a labor of love. Thank you.
Any final comments, Representative Howes, Chair Howes?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the city of Bemidji would be the fiduciary agent in this, and I would appreciate any good recommendation that this committee could send on to the next committee.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your being here today.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much.
Representative Hansen. Welcome. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 684, and I know we're moving quickly. I have a couple of testifiers. House File 684 is a bonding request for funds to go to the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission for grants to local units of government. You may remember a few years ago we had some discussions about air handling, air quality issues at indoor ice arenas. What this bill does is it provides funds for improving those HVAC systems at indoor ice arenas around the state. There is a need. I have two folks here who are going to testify to that need. In addition to the bonding proposal, it also has some changes to the statutory language for the Mighty Ducks program to allow for this type of mini grants out to local units of government, and it changes the cap on the grants. So the Mighty Ducks program has been here for almost 20 years. It's been a successful effort with local units of government, but some of our facilities are aging, and so this is an opportunity to provide for fixes around the state. So I have with me representatives from South St. Paul and from Mankato.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Council, we are. I'm Jason Dwelly from the Wakota Arena in the city of South St. Paul. I am one of those aging facilities that Representative Hansen spoke of.
You don't look very old.
Wow. My facility is one of the aging facilities. We have a tremendous amount of need in a facility that old. And as a lot of ranks around the state are, we are a general tax levy supported facility. Our revenue basically covers our operation, and all of our capital improvements are funded through the general fund, which, as everybody knows, there's a lot of competition for general fund dollars at this point. Anything that can be done to help with funding of a project like this will absolutely expedite it, and it'll help us get within the, help maintain our status among, or with the good standing with the Minnesota Department of Health and their new rulemaking for the indoor air quality. I have several options available to me at my facility as far as upgrades. Some are better than others. I think I've on the handout that you received, there's a few options listed there. Any kind of funding would help expedite a project like this, and it would absolutely help us with moving forward with these projects that will help us maintain indoor air quality.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Paul Ostoff. I'm the All Seasons Arena Ice Arena Manager in Mankato, Minnesota. I'm also part of the Indoor Air Quality Committee for MIAMA, which is the Ice Arena Managers Association in Minnesota. A couple things I think that we've been talking about is the need with the new rule revisions that are coming down from the Department of Health. And I want to commend them on the work that they've done recently, and I'm sure you're going to see their proposals coming down. But that work right now is probably going to put some of our ice arenas in real tight positions. Air quality at our facilities meets the standards currently, but with the new revisions, once if they pass and if they're adopted, they're going to put several arenas really right on the cusp of being able to meet those requirements. Facilities that were built long ago that don't have ventilation systems, facilities that have aging equipment, those types of facilities, or facilities that don't have any ventilation at all, that are probably in need of electric-type resurfacers or electric-type ice edgers, those types of facilities are going to be put in jeopardy. You know, one of the issues that we have is that is money right now. We have a lot of associations that are operated by youth hockey associations, for example. They're not operated by city government. They're not operated. They receive all their funding through the individuals that attend those facilities. For example, hockey associations, players and parents pay fees to keep their facilities operating without any outside funding. I'll give you a good example. Cloquet, Minnesota has a high school hockey game. 1,500 people show up. The parents, immediately after the game, are out there sweeping the bleachers, cleaning the facility, cleaning the toilets, cleaning the bathrooms in order to keep that facility operating. To meet the new rule changes, it's going to be very difficult for them to provide additional funding to provide the equipment to do that. And so, you know, this money that we're asking for hopefully will help those facilities meet those requirements. Some facilities won't need any funding. In fact, the vast majority of our facilities may not need any funding at all. In Mankato, our facility is all electric. We have updated ventilation systems. We're not going to ask for any money. We're just asking for the facilities that are going to be in dire need in order to keep their buildings open. And I think that's really the big issue that's going to happen. If the health department revisions don't pass, I would say shame on Minnesota, because those revisions are based on science and technology that these kids need when they're in our facilities. You know, that we don't want the kids skating in a situation and exercising in situations where their health is at risk. And hopefully with the passing of the new health revisions, we'll see improved quality in all of our facilities. And our existing facilities that are in trouble or that are financially underfunded, we'll find a way, you know, so that they can fund themselves.
Representative Hansen, has anyone surveyed how many facilities around the state, Mighty Ducks facilities, are in need of upgrades on their systems? And if so, this $1.5 million, how far is that going to go? When it gets to HVAC, obviously, dollars can rack up pretty quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would defer to the MIAMA representatives, the Minnesota Ice Arena Association. As was discussed, there are some that aren't going to need any. My intent would be that the grants go to the worst first, the ones that are in the most dire need. And 1.5, like you said, is not going to go that far, but hopefully we can get the worst first with this.
Yeah, I would say that 1.5 will really help the facilities that are initially really impacted that may not be able to meet the current needs. And I think there'll be enough money to go around, provided that those facilities apply for the grants and are able to receive the grants. It's going to be interesting to see how the Minnesota Department of Health, when they see the records, when they check the facilities to see how they're doing. But I think this 1.5 would really go a long ways helping right after this bill, after the revisions are passed, or if they are passed. And it would really help our kids out in those communities that are really struggling financially to keep their doors open at this time.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And go along with that just a little bit, and maybe you don't know the answer, but do you know how many ice arenas are there in Minnesota?
Well, there's over 200, just slightly over 200, about 208, I believe. It kind of varies. It depends on, you know, what month it is sometimes. There's a few that open and close, some private arenas, those types of things. But about 208, I believe, something like that. Department of Health, I think, currently has identified all of them, and they are visiting all of them.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, there's part of the law, although not changed in your bill, is on page 2. 2.25 to 2.29, which is the requirement for 50% of the prime time going to female groups. Is anyone watching to see that that's being obeyed, or is it just on a complaint recommended one? And I noticed that it doesn't, you know, this was for the construction. No, I don't know if it's also a requirement in these renovation facilities. And is there some, you know, what happens with that?
Mr. Carlson has the answer to that.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Joel Carlson. I've been a member of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission since 2003. And we absolutely do monitor that the appropriate amount of ice time is available for both male and female hockey players, and that doesn't include the times when I'm skating with you. So we do monitor that.
That's not covered by the bill.
That's unchanged. That's unchanged by the bill, and we do monitor it. And I would also say, Mr. Chairman and members, while all arenas now are currently meeting the current air quality requirements, we do know that some of them are going to need upgrade when the new standards are put into place. I served on the Department of Health Task Force that rewrote those rules, and they are good standards. They have good buy-in from arena managers and owners, cities, school districts, and those few privates that we do have. So we absolutely support what Representative Hansen's trying to do here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. We can
timer.
We need to get on to the next bill.
Just real quick,
okay,
Mr. Chair. I just want to tell Representative Hansen thank you. I think this is a better effort than you've made in the past, perhaps, on this issue. And, so thank you for that. I just want to throw in that the Wacuda Arena is quite a nice arena. I'm from North St. Paul, though. This is in South St. Paul, and they make me get dressed in the parking lot for some reason. I don't know why that is, but we played last Friday, and the former governor was there, and former Representative Carlson, and we were short a goalie, so based on Representative Hansen's past bill, I was wondering if we could get him to. I was wondering if the Wacuda Arena had extra goalie pads that Representative Hansen might be able to wear.
Mr. Chair, we do not.
Looking forward to seeing you, Representative Hansen.
Well, he doesn't need pads, then.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. And Representative Clark.
You made it through it.
Yeah. Pretty impressive.
Welcome, and I'm sorry, but we're down to the last 5 minutes here, so please help us out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll be brief. There will be an amendment. I just want to mention there will be an amendment to the amount that's being asked for in the Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery restoration. It will be reduced to 2.1. I don't think you're taking action on bills today, but just to let you know, that will be reduced with an amendment 2.1. Let me just say that I'm going to go right to our witnesses. Request from the bond proceeds from the Minnesota Historical Society, or to the Minnesota Historical Society, is for Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery, the only cemetery in Minnesota that's listed as an individual landmark in the National Registry of Historic Places. It's fabulous project. And then for someone to turn to City Council Member Gary Schiff.
Hi, my name is Gary Schiff, Minneapolis City Council Member. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for your time today. We will be brief. I was lucky to be raised in a household with a World War I veteran and have a deep appreciation for our veterans, many of whom are buried in this cemetery. This cemetery is the oldest in the city of Minneapolis, originally established in 1853. The fence, the original fence, has badly deteriorated, subjecting the gravestones to vandalism and to weather. And we ask for funding today to complete the restoration of the fence that began with City of Minneapolis commitments, as well as small grants and private fundraising dollars to date. Altogether, it's a $3 million project, $3.1 million project, which has already begun. Some of the most basic repairs have happened to try to protect gravestones from vandalism. The gravestones themselves are restored with private dollars from families, but the remaining work to be done will help protect the graves of four veterans of the War of 1812, 175 Civil War veterans, 16 veterans of the Spanish-American War, and numerous people who participated in the Dakota conflict. And so we ask for your funding, because at this rate, the current small grants process that are available won't complete this project in a reasonable period of time. And we really view this as a statewide resource of the original settlers and pioneers who made Minnesota what it is today.
Mr. Chairman, just a few brief words from the project manager, Aaron.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Aaron Hanauer. I would just want to reiterate what's already been said, but just this public face of the cemetery is viewed by tens of thousands of people daily, with those passing by Lake Street and taking the light rail. It's highly visible, and this would restore the great pride that the community does have in the cemetery.
Mr. Chairman, I'd finally like to introduce Susan Hunter Ware, who's our local historian and the president of the Friends of the Cemetery. Any question you might have about any historical fact related to this cemetery, she can answer.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, who pays the upkeep of the cemetery on a regular basis?
City of Minneapolis.
Council membership?
City of Minneapolis.
City of Minneapolis, out of the general fund or out of the parks fund?
Out of the general
fund. Council membership?
Out of our public works department.
Any other questions for... Thank you for being concise and to the point. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you. We appreciate your support.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Members, tomorrow we will have the Downey Bill, House File 2033. And on Thursday we will have Swedzinski Rulemaking Bill. And a Downey bill. Okay. So that's the plan for the rest of the week. You're reminded there's a Valentine treat, chocolate treat there at the end of the table. And please put your score sheet here in the save file in your folder so you have it next time. Meeting adjourned.